Hello and welcome to the RCGP podcasts. My name is Dr. Thomas Round and I'm the Essential Knowledge Updates Clinical Lead. And today I'm speaking to Professor Carolyn Jew Graham. Carolyn is a GP in Manchester and Professor of Primary Care Research at Keele University with an active interest in mental health research. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, hello. Good to be here. Yeah, I do a lot of research around mental health interventions in primary care.
And today we're talking about self-harm. So this links to recent NICE guidance. We also have an RCGP EKU module on self-harm. Really great to have you, Carolyn, your expertise, and really speaking today as a GP colleague with a specialist interest in mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not speaking as a researcher with expertise in self-harm and suicide, I'm speaking as a GP, but we'll pull in some of the recent evidence and some of the guidance.
Thinking about self-harm, what is it? How common is it? How we might define it?
Okay, so you mentioned the NICE guideline. So this was published in 2022, NICE guideline 255. And this covers assessment, management and preventing recurrence for children, young people and adults with self-harm behaviour. And the guideline defines self-harm quite strictly. So it's about intentional self-poisoning or injury, irrespective of apparent purpose. It doesn't cover repetitive self-injurious behaviour such as headbanging. And it's also worth noting that I've conducted some research into self-harm and suicide. And working with people with lived experience, our patients and public advisory groups, they often talk about other behaviours that they consider to be self-harm. Overeating, controlling food intake, consuming excess alcohol, and NICE guidance doesn't cover these.
We think it's most common in young people, if that's right. I mean, how common would it be?
Yeah, self-harm is common in young people, but actually it occurs across the whole life course. And I think we often forget that when we're talking to older adults who have got depressive illnesses. So we think about 17% of people will self-harm in their lifetime. And self-harm behaviour often starts in the very early teenage years. And we think in terms of the method of self-harm that nearly half people who self-harm, it will be by means of cutting. And self-harm is often a repeated behaviour, so it's rare to see somebody who self-harms once.
I understand that certain groups are more at risk. So we talked a little bit there around adolescents, young people, students. Are there any other particular groups we need to be aware of? I think it's more common in females. Is that right as well?
Yeah, so women are more likely to self-harm than males. But I think it's also important that men may not present with self-harm. And we also know that the suicide rate in males is higher, particularly in those middle-aged men and older men. So there's a link between self-harm and suicide that we can talk about. It's important to be clear about which groups of people are most at risk of self-harm and which are most at risk of suicide. So you mentioned adolescents. And as I've said already, it's across the life course. So it isn't just young people. It can occur in anybody who is distressed or has got mental health problems. And it's been increasingly identified recently that gay and bisexual people are at high risk of self-harm. Self-harm also occurs in people who've got mental health problems. Historically, I think we always talked about borderline personality disorder, and it's much better now to refer that as sort of emotional instability or emotionally unstable personality problems. But self-harm is associated with eating disorders. So it's thought that about 50% of people who have an eating disorder will self-harm. People who've got anxiety and depression may self-harm to relieve the distress. And people who abuse substances, so drugs and alcohol, are at risk of self-harm.
So actually then quite a lot of mental health comorbidity, you know, as I say, it's a presentation of self-harm. It could be a first presentation of a mental health diagnosis, or I guess it's interesting to explore that and we might discuss that a little bit further.
People can self-harm because they're distressed. They don't necessarily have to have an underlying mental health problem. Children and adolescents may self-harm because they're being bullied or there's problems through social media. People may self-harm if there's sexual or physical or even emotional abuse. Any life events, so bereavement, loss of a home, loss of a job, money worries can cause people to be distressed, and then in association with that, they will self-harm. So people who've got difficult and pleasant feelings, they're distressed, can resort to self-harm to try and manage those feelings. But then, as I've said already, self-harm can be associated with a mental health problem, such as anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder. It's a really important presentation. Someone's got treatment-resistant depression, or you think they have, and they are self-harming. Think, have they got bipolar disorder? And of course, people can self-harm as a psychosis emerges. So trying to explore with a person why they think the self-harming is really important, because it can help you understand their psychosocial context, but it can also help you decide whether there's a mental health problem underlying the self-harm.
And how about explore that in primary care? Because we might not always be the first person that they consult, or it could be exploring that consultation as part of a mental health consultation.
Yeah, so some people who self-harm won't seek any help at all. Other people will end up in the emergency departments because they've got cuts or burns that actually need medical attention, or they think, or family think they need medical attention. But some people will come to the practice or be spoken to on the telephone, as often happens now. And it's important for the GP to consider self-harm as something that might be going on with this person. So I suppose the commonest would be if somebody has depression, it's always important to ask about self-harm behaviour and thoughts of suicide. Similarly with anxiety, mentioned bipolar disorder, somebody with a psychotic illness. Somebody with an eating disorder, you know, 50% of people will be self-harming. So ask about that. So I think in general practice, we're often not presented with somebody coming in saying, I self-harm. They come in with other problems, yeah. Distressed, stressed. I want antidepressants. And it's up to us to explore whether associated with that, they are at risk of self-harm or they are self-harming.
And maybe in a way, it's non-judgmentally normalizing that discussion, a bit like we might think, you know, we try to normalize. It's quite common people think about harming yourself. We just want to explore that with you without any stigma or any judgment.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really important, because people who self-harm will often describe consultations that they've had before with paramedics or with A&E or previous GPs, where they feel that they have been criticized for their self-harm behavior. They feel that they're stigmatized, and therefore they don't want to then admit it in the future. So it's really important for us to be open about it and ask in a normalizing way. Sometimes when people feel, as you're describing, they feel like harming themselves, is that something you feel? Is that something you're doing? Can I see the cuts? Do you want to talk about it? What sort of help can we give you? So opening up a conversation about it. But I think that needs to be in the context of a collaborative therapeutic relationship. You know, it's much easier, I think, to have a conversation with a person about self-harm if you know them, if you've seen them on a couple of occasions or spoken to them on a couple of occasions before. And I think increasingly we're delivering transactional consultations, which may make it more difficult for people to disclose that they're self-harming, because they don't know the doctor and they feel the doctor doesn't know them.
It's that importance of that therapeutic continuity of care and that relationship-based care that we have with patients that we can do well. You know, thinking about some of the research in this area, so I think we touched on that having a non-judgmental approach. Maybe there's this idea in society that it's a sort of attention-seeking, but I think we need to move away from that. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And as I've said, if people feel that a clinician thinks that they're attention-seeking, some patients have described to me how they've been told in an emergency department, oh, you're just attention-seeking. They're not. They're distressed. And we need to help them understand why they might be self-harming to deal with the distress, and therefore how we can help them deal with the stress in a more positive way.
Yeah, I think we touched on that. Many people might not attend. Sometimes it might be the emergency room. We might not always see it as the acute presentation in primary care, but it would probably be more for that long-term care.
Yeah, so anybody who's got a mood disorder, anybody who has got an eating disorder, somebody's abusing drugs or alcohol, think about self-harm and suicide ideation.
Is there a link between self-harm and suicide?
Well, there is, in that people who kill themselves, people who take their own lives, have often got a history of self-harm behaviour. And people who self-harm are at increased risk of suicide. I think the important thing to say is that there are no risk assessment tools that are available and validated for us to use. So we don't know if somebody is sitting in front of us with self-harm behaviour, who's just self-harm, there's no way of knowing through a tool or a scale of what the risk is of them going on to do that again or going on to kill themselves. So it's really important that it's a discussion, a dialogue that's had in that consultation, trying to find out what underlies their distress, what precipitates the self-harm, and how we might best to support them ourselves as GPs, but also what services are available around, and assess the risk. You know, are they at risk now? Do they actually need to be referred to the crisis team or the home-based treatment team, whatever you've got in your locality? But don't rely on a scale, because there isn't a validated scale.
Thinking a bit more about that consultation, exploring it, we touched on a little bit that patient, it might not be the reason they've come in, but we have elicited a bit of a history of self-harm. We've said we wouldn't need risk assessment tools. What would our sort of next steps be in that consultation?
So trying to explore with them what the self-harm behaviour means to them. Do they use it when they're distressed, when they've been bullied through social media? Do they use it if they've had an argument with their parent or boyfriend or with an older person? Do they use it if there's a problem with the neighbours? So find out why it's used. What value does it relieve their distress? Think also about what the patient wants to achieve in that consultation. So they've talked about their initial presentation. You've elicited that they are self-harming. So what is it that we can do moving forwards? Think about suicide ideation. Do they have any thoughts of suicide? So we establish that they're cutting or they're burning themselves, but actually, do they ever think they might want to cut themselves and bleed to death? If they do, have they got any specific plans? Have they got any protective factors? So do we need to escalate this? Always ask about alcohol and drugs and ask about previous history of mental health problems. And if it's a young person, think, is this an emerging psychosis? Might this be a bipolar disorder? Also consider neurodiversity, because again, people with neurodiversity may present with self-harm. They may present with anxiety and depression, which are more difficult to treat. And, you know, always have at the back of your mind, this might be an emotionally unstable personality disorder, but rather than dismiss it at that, say, so what can I do about it? Think about using the GAD-7 or PHQ-9 to assess severity of anxiety and depression. And when, as a GP, we've got the full picture, and this may be over two consultations fairly close together, then think with the young person or the older person who's got self-harm behaviour, what can we do moving forward? How can we help? Are there any safeguarding concerns? Thinking about somebody I saw who was a mother on her own with two children. Do I need to do anything about the children? Thinking about older adults. Actually, is there a problem? This person's a carer for their spouse with dementia. So safeguarding, as always, comes into our consultations. Develop a management plan. Think about a safety plan if there's any suicide ideation. And I think most importantly, you know, establish a relationship and offer proactive care. You know, say to the patient, well, I'd like to see you again in X. Is that all right with you? Shall I book the appointment now to save them going to the desk, or to save them going to the desk and getting there and being told, oh, she's not got any appointments? So really establish with the person, show the person that you care. You're going to invest in them. You're going to see them on a regular basis. And think about what other resources are available in your area. So would social prescribing help if this person's got a problem with loneliness? Does this person need to be referred to NHS talking therapies? Can they refer themselves? Does this person need referral because you think they might have bipolar? So I need to refer to secondary care. So make sure before the person leaves the room, you've got a plan. They are happy with the plan. They've got a safety plan. And there's an arrangement for you to follow them up, whether that be next week or next month.
That's really helpful. Thanks, Carolyn. And I think it's really important to stress, you know, it's about that initial kind of safety plan, isn't it? It doesn't all have to be done in one consultation, but it's important to have that continuity, that relationship, but have that safety netting in place. And I guess for trainees who might be listening, it's really, you know, speak to your supervisor or colleagues if you get a bit stuck. But, you know, if you're immediately worried, then of course, then pick up the phone, speak to mental health services if you are worried about this individual.
Yes, and I think you raise an important point that as a GP, it's sometimes difficult sitting with these people, holding them. And so making use of the broader team. If you've got any mental health practitioners in your practice, then talking to them. Do you have any supervision? You know, certainly a chat in the kitchen, as long as the kitchen's not off the waiting room, but having a chat with your colleagues to say, gosh, I've just seen so-and-so, slightly worried about them, just to recalibrate, but also to give yourself some support.
Yeah, and then obviously having that sort of follow-up and seeing if there's any concomitant diagnoses. So we touched about anxiety, depression, which are very common presentations to us as GPs. That could be a co-presentation with the self-harm. And then thinking, I guess, about appropriate medication if you have an underlying or another concomitant diagnosis.
Yeah, absolutely. So if someone's got anxiety or depression, then consider talking therapies first, but also, you know, are antidepressants appropriate? But if you think they are, then small amounts because of the risk of overdose, so, you know, and very early follow-up. But medication probably has a small role to play unless, you know, you're quite convinced that they've got a more severe depression or moderate to severe anxiety disorder.
I'm more thinking here about the teenager and young person, thinking about specific support for them. So that could be their CAMHS or other, depending on your local area, that could be third sector or other charity or other organisations that could be supportive for mental health.
I don't know about in your area, Thomas, but certainly where I work, getting access to CAMHS is really difficult. So we have something called COOTH, which is an online resource that people can access. but also saying to the young person, what's available in your school? Do you have a pastoral support? Is there any counselling available? And then there are some voluntary community organisations. We've got 42nd Street in Manchester. Bit of a waiting time, but actually once people get engaged, they do seem to value that. There are also some drop-in services that you need to be aware of that may be for young people, maybe for older people. So look at what's available in your area, because CAMHS may not be the service that is able to accommodate them.
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, as you rightly say, school and other approaches, given waiting lists, the severity that CAMHS often would be their priority. I think we do have a key role in thinking about the other resources in our communities that we can utilise for patients.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then just think about sort of next steps. So we've seen the patient, we follow them up, we've got a safety netting and plan. And any other top tips for GPs and maybe where next with this area?
So I think in terms of being a GP, it's about establishing that relationship, offering proactive care. If they miss an appointment, chasing them up, you know, sending a text, giving them a ring, sending a letter. Really worried about, why have you missed your appointment? Do you want to come in, make another appointment? To make sure we don't lose them, because I think that continuity and offering support is a really important part of what we do in general practice. And it may be that we can have a conversation with them about distraction techniques or coping strategies, or think about how to manage their wounds in terms of the physical. We can talk to them about alcohol and drugs, but there aren't any evidence-based interventions at the moment that GPs can deliver. As I say, NHS talking therapies will be of use if someone's got anxiety or depression, but it may be that it's the relationship with the GP, and we need to be there, because are they developing a psychosis, or is this an older adult who has been bereaved, has got a little bit depressed, has started to self-harm? We need to be there to prevent a suicide. So it's being proactive and supporting people, and that may be a 10-minute consultation every month or every couple of weeks, depending on the level of risk, and that may vary depending on the individual, but it's that holding that we do in general practice so well. I think that's important. And then you asked about research. I'd always suggest to people that they look at the University of Manchester National Confidential Inquiry into Suicide and Safety and Mental Health. I mean, it's led by Lewis Appleby. It's a world-leading research centre. Have a look at the reports that are published at least annually, because that tells you exactly what's going on in research. I think there's a couple of areas that need developing, and one of my PhD students is actually working to develop an intervention for GPs to work with young people in routine consultations, and he's evaluating that. I think the role of paramedics in supporting people with self-harm behaviour is important. They're often the people who come into contact with somebody who's self-harmed. The family call the ambulance go in, maybe, you know, bandage them up, maybe take them to A&E, but maybe leave them at home. What do paramedics say to people? Is there training needed in that area? And how do paramedics cope with that exposure? Also building on the research that we actually do have. So years ago, I was involved in a trial of an interpersonal therapy delivered by liaison mental health practitioners in A&E following an episode of self-poisoning. And this intervention was effective, it was commissioned. And then with one of the NHS reorganisations and different organisations moving to one, in order to make sure that all services were equal, that service was lost from the emergency department in which it had been commissioned. And I think there is a lot of research wastage, and it's sad that we don't always learn from existing evidence.
I think it's a really great summary. Thanks, Carolyn. And I think, look, if people want to learn more, we have our Essential Knowledge Updates module on the college website. We also have a big mental health hub as well for further advice and support in this area. And I guess this could be quite triggering, you know, listening to this. It could have relatives or other friends who maybe have self-harmed or have mental health issues. So yeah, please do reach out if you need support. I think we have such a crucial role in our, and having that relationship-based care with patients is so important.
But looking after ourselves is also really important. So if you're in a partnership or you've got a supportive team around you, make use of that team. Think about balance groups. Think about first five groups. Think about the practitioner health programme if you're having problems. Because we as doctors have mental health problems. Some doctors have self-harm behaviour, and it shouldn't be stigmatised. People should be able to disclose it and discuss it. So yeah, please reach out for support.
Yeah, thank you so much, Karen. And thank you. It's always a pleasure to speak to you today. And thank you for listening. My name is Dr. Thomas Round. This was the RCGP Essential Knowledge Updates podcast.